I'm Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
We're going to be talking today with Justin Seitz. Justin's written a couple books on Python programming. He runs a OSINT training program and is just built a investigative tool called Hunchly. So we're going to talk to him today. And what I would encourage you to do is take advantage of this. I've talked with Justin for a number of months now. He's a wealth of information, you know, both practical and theoretical, and has that unique talent of being also to translate highly technical jargon into plain English, which is always welcome. So with that, Justin, let me welcome you aboard.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me. You can decipher my Canadian accent, which is good. I'll try to say about as often as possible.
So let's just start at the beginning, if it's okay, Justin. And can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got in this field, and sort of what led you to where you are now?
Absolutely. So for the past decade or so, I worked in offensive security, which is kind of fancy talk for I was a professional hacker. So I spent a lot of time working on behalf of Fortune 500, law enforcement, and others, both teaching hacking technique, building hacking tools, writing exploits, and generally, you know, working for the good guys doing bad things. And through a lot of that, what we always had to do was perform open source intelligence. So, for example, if a large financial institution was going to hire us to break into one of their banking systems, and either that's through people or through technical means, we would use open source intelligence to determine what is important to this company, who are their strategic relationships, what kind of information, once we've broken in, is going to be valuable and what's going to have the biggest impact. So a lot of that work was kind of built into our job, that we had to be good at open source intelligence. We had to be good at doing things like looking at LinkedIn profiles for professional relationships, examining social media, and of course being able to dig into corporate documents. And so I used a lot of that framed around computer hacking, and slowly that transitioned into me actually focusing exclusively on open source intelligence as kind of a professional career, just focusing generally on training and building tools and teaching people how to perform OSINT in the modern time.
So I think it's worthwhile. A lot of people, when they hear OSINT, they might think Twitter or Facebook. Can you talk a little bit about what is encompassed in that term, OSINT? What are we talking about here?
Well, really, to me, and I think just like any other term, I think it's kind of relative to the person, but to me, open source intelligence is anything that does not require a covert or clandestine method of gathering information. And that can also include things under warrant, for example, like intercepts, wiretaps. So anything that we can gather from news sources, social media, anything that's publicly available to us that we can either just go out and retrieve or that we can pay through legitimate means to retrieve. And that's going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Of course, you have access to a lot more information in the United States than we do in Canada. But that's typically what I look at, is that I don't require a warrant or any type of covert operation to acquire this information. Does this include printed news? And of course it does. So there's even been cases that I've spoke to people that they've, for example, looked at flyers and printed newspapers in a general area of companies or business owners that might have been up to no good or committing fraud. And they're actually hunting through news clippings, like real news clippings and real classified, printed classified, looking for ads and extracting information like phone numbers from it that has really nothing to do with the computer. I include all of that as part of open source intelligence.
I seem to recall, way before the internet was nearly as big as it is now, I think it was either a current or a serving or former director of Central Intelligence who had indicated that he thought that probably 80% of the intelligence work that needed to be done could be done with open source information. And that was before the information sort of dump that the internet has become. And that actually leads into my next question, which is, so you said you've been doing this for about 10 years. Can you describe a little bit about how the landscape has changed since you started this field?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about 10 years ago, 2006, a lot of the social media, for example, that we have today didn't exist or was really in its infancy. So that is a huge shift in how we've been able to kind of extract information from the web. And we've even seen how social media platforms have changed a lot over that time as well. Even things that we really think are kind of highly interesting, like, for example, looking at the geographic location of tweets. That's something that was really popular a few years ago, 5-10 years ago, things that just kind of by default gave away your location information. And now the shift has been to kind of protect people from that, even though we can still get it. We've seen a shift in that, right? So even though a lot of these things didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago, the common thing that I see is that these sources of information are continually changing over time. So new sources pop up that we might not have thought of or might not have even used. And as these things pop up and gain popularity, we then see them start to shift and change. And it's really kind of the interesting thing that it's always this ongoing challenge of trying to stay ahead of what is going to be the next big platform, where should we spend our recent research and development time figuring out where people are going to start talking. I mean, even with Twitter itself, we saw a lot of extremist groups using it, still using it today. But you've seen Twitter respond, you've seen the general public respond, you've seen their numbers dwindle, in particular with ISIS. Their numbers beginning to dwindle compared to where they were a couple of years ago, but then they shifted platforms onto things like Telegram. So we didn't have a lot of this stuff 5 or 10 years ago, but the cool thing is that having that investigative eye and just kind of generally keeping your finger on the pulse of what's going on online and where people are hanging out, just by developing that skill allows you to kind of always make sure that no matter where people go and where they're talking and what platforms they're using, you're always able to change along with them.
And it, of course, it requires, right, it requires you to not just be technically proficient on how to search in that one platform, but you also kind of have to have your ear to the ground about the shifts, right, the cultural shifts in terms of where it's going next. So, right, the cliche now is like Facebook used to be for kids, now it's for their parents, really, and kids have moved on, you know, some time ago, right? So,
yep.
That seems like it's a whole additional skill.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that's we see the challenges continually where a lot of people are kind of worried about encryption and other things, but really when you look at it, it's like even the challenges of how do we gain the same intelligence we were getting on people Facebook now from Snapchat, right? And so these things require you to continually be, you know, not only upgrading your skills, but also paying attention that the platforms are changing, right? So Facebook used to be just a website. That's all it was. That's how you accessed it. That's how you interacted with it. But now what we're seeing, of course, is a lot of this stuff is moving into mobile. And so we have to not only learn a whole new social media platform like Snapchat, but we have to figure out ways how we can gain intelligence from it while it's on a different platform like an Android phone or an iPhone.
Could you give some of the listeners a quick overview of what Telegram is if they haven't heard about it?
Sure. So Telegram is a kind of an online gathering place that has encrypted communications and encrypted chat. This allows people to kind of discuss anonymously online or pseudo-anonymously, I should say, online. And it's become popular with a number of extremist groups along with other people. I think that what I don't want people to think is that Telegram is now going to be like the end-all be-all where bad people can hang out online. I just think it's a different site. It's a different set of technologies. It has its own weaknesses that leaves people vulnerable to analysis. But it is an improvement over, for example, what we saw, 10 or 15 years ago where a lot of extremist groups relied on forums, for example. So that's all it is. It's very easy. There's a link that was just posted to the Telegram site itself. I also encourage you, if you're interested in Telegram and specifically how Telegram fits into counterterrorism, Rukmini Kalamaki from the New York Times is an excellent resource. She spends a lot of time investigating ISIS and other extremist groups on Telegram. So she's really got a very good handle on how this stuff works. She's published a number of articles for the New York Times. There's also a podcast called Reply All that's put out by Gimlet Media. Rukmini did an interview on Reply All where they kind of talked to her about a lot of this. So she's a great resource. Read her stuff and you'll get a really good understanding of Telegram and specifically kind of how it's a bit of a nexus for some of these groups.
Awesome. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about a couple of the notable projects you've worked on over the past decade or so that might sort of exemplify, you know, what the possibilities are with Docent.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the formative projects that actually kind of got me to branch out and work on open source intelligence pretty much exclusively now is I had got an idea about 3 or 4 years ago, really even before ISIS was a big thing, before we saw this huge surge by them. And so what I had started to look at was, how do we actually find these people on Twitter? And one of the things that dawned on me early on was, I'm not even a bilingual Canadian, so I can't speak French. As you can tell, even my English is not particularly great. But this proved to be a big challenge for me a number of years ago, because how do we find these people online usually is set down to language. And so we're always interested in doing text-based searches. I mean, this is why Google is a multi-billion dollar company, is we expect to be able to search for things in text. But when that text is in Arabic, traditionally, even though there's other languages used in extremist content, at the time it was primarily Arabic. And so one of the things that I kind of sat down and started thinking about was, well, if I can find one or two people online that are aligned with the ISIS kind of ideology and support them, what patterns can I look at that would make, you know, what kind of common things can I see? And so one of the things that kind of jumped out to me, as it would have jumped out to a number of people, is that obviously the black flag, which has some fundamental tenets of Islam embedded in it that ISIS has kind of hijacked, it was always present in all of their imagery and their propaganda, their videos. And so I had thought that perhaps if I could actually detect that black flag in Twitter profile users, in the profile picture of users, in their background images, or in any propaganda that they had, any photos that they had posted, that actually might give me a pretty good idea of somebody who is supporting that ideology or supporting that group. Now, of course, there's always caveats, because there very well potentially could be investigative journalists or counterterrorism researchers who are also posting these things, but they would definitely be in the minority. So I developed some technology, just kind of some homegrown stuff using kind of image recognition. And what this thing would do is just crawl out. I could just point it at any account. So I could point it at my own Twitter account, and it would start crawling outwards through Twitter from my friends and the people who follow me. So the people I follow and the people who follow me. And then it would crawl around going account to account to account, looking for those images. And if there was a match, if we found an image that contained the black flag, I would kind of have this list of all these accounts that would have all of these potential matches. And then I demonstrated how you could take all of these accounts and begin to do analysis on them so that I could actually prove or disprove whether my hypothesis was correct, which was, does this actually work as a way to find people who support this ideology? And it did end up working. I presented the results at a conference up here in Canada. And I realized that there's actually, you know, aside from the hacking world, that there's some actual kind of overall social good and public safety good that we can do by doing this research. And I'm just one guy from, you know, kind of nowhere Canada doing this stuff. So my thought was really, like, if we can do this stuff as one person with a $0 budget, that maybe we could start to spur other people into asking those questions of what if or how can, right? So this also led into some future work that I did a few months ago, where I developed some technology, again, for free, leveraging completely free resources. And this is all published on my blog as a step-by-step. But I wrote code and figured out a way that we can actually detect weapons in social media posts. So you could, for example, download all the tweets from an account and run all the tweets through this little software that I wrote, and it would come back and tell you whether it detected weapons or firearms in those posts. And again, this was not something that took a long time. It was not something that was exceedingly expensive. It was simply me just asking a research question, like, I wonder if I can actually detect whether photos have guns in them. And it turns out that you can, and you can do so relatively reliably and at very low cost.
That's actually a great point, because certainly when you're talking about law enforcement, intelligence agencies, investigative journalists, when you're trying to acquire a new capability, right, one of the first questions is always, oh my God, how much is this going to cost me? So I was wondering if maybe you've touched on it a little bit, but if you could talk a little bit about maybe what the requirements or the barriers to entry would be of working with OSINT like you've described. What are the knowledge requirements? You clearly have a good technical background, but what could somebody starting from zero do? What could somebody who's a little more sophisticated do? And what would the cost maybe in terms of time and resources and money look like?
Sure. So, you know, this is a really common question that I get, especially in kind of the law enforcement circles that I travel in. And, you know, the big thing to me is to reiterate that all of the knowledge that you need, for example, if we're going to use street gangs in my home province, which is Saskatchewan, all of the knowledge that you need to do OSINT is actually, you already possess it. You know all the lingo, you know all the street terms, you know which gangs are present, which ones aren't. And the real fundamental thing is that first step, which is, even if that means Googling, right? So something starting very simple, which is Googling, which means the barrier to entry is actually nearly zero. And so starting even as simple as a Google search, in a lot of cases, I know a lot of people who just won't take that step because they don't feel like they know how to do online research or open source intelligence. And so a lot of it is just getting people over that mental hurdle that first step is just a Google search. And then the next thing is to think about where your targets are operating online. You have access to forensics for, in some cases, for gang members for years. You know what apps they use. You know they're on Facebook. It's a matter of figuring out where are these people hanging out and then just going and using those text-based searches, because that's actually going to get you quite a ways to start. Now, like anything, you need to continue to develop those skills, and that's always going to require training, and it's going to require a little bit of the how-to work. So understanding how to do searches in Facebook, understanding how to do really kind of more advanced searches on Google. But all of these things are kind of stepping stones. And the beautiful thing is, especially when it comes to law enforcement, is that all of your investigative training does not get thrown out the window just because you're sitting in front of a keyboard, right? All of that stuff is exactly the same. All those things you've learned, all those techniques that you have that you've done for maybe 20 years as a police officer or other member of law enforcement or as an investigator, all those things still hold true. And so you can't abandon, again, it's the psychology around it is that the minute I sit in front of a keyboard, all of my other training goes out the window. And that's just totally not right. That you want to continually remember that all of that stuff directly applies to what you're doing online. And then it spins off into all these other things that once you start doing higher and higher risk investigations online, you have to also learn how to protect yourself and protect your identity and make sure that your department's policies are up to date so that you can even perform these investigations. But to get started, really, the barriers to entry is as simple as a Google search. And then from there, really, it's all about starting to get trained up in terms of just expanding those capabilities. And a great place to go online to do this, there's a fantastic trainer in the United States. Sure, a lot of you might have heard of him already. His name is Michael Basil. And he has a website that's called IntelTechniques.com. And there's a forum there where there's, I think, over 1,000 or more people that hang out there, including myself. Michael himself is on there as well. I know there's actually, I can see some people in this presentation who I know are on the forums as well. This is a great place that you can go in and you can see practitioners of open source intelligence asking questions of one another, sharing techniques, talking about how they're approaching certain problems. And even that, even if you just spend, say, 30 minutes a morning with your first cup of coffee, log into the forums and going through all the new topics, it'll only take you about 30 minutes. And you will be amazed at how much knowledge you're going to build. Michael also has a book that you can purchase that teaches a lot of these fundamental things. And you'd be surprised how quickly you can pick this stuff up and really develop some of these capabilities.
Wow. So what do you think for an agency that maybe has never done this before? Are there some sort of quick wins you think if there was an advocate in an agency who was trying to push to develop this capability more that they could do and show their agency head, their boss, their chief, their editor, whatever, to sort of encourage more resources in that?
You know, that's always tricky to answer because it's a context-specific problem, right? But, I mean, I can speak to a number of organizations, law enforcement and non-law enforcement, where you have that one detective, you have that one senior journalist who's like, I just can't get people to want to do this, right? Or I can't get the funding, or I just can't get people to get it. Can you help? And so sometimes it's as simple as calling in someone like me or other people like Michael or other people in the community and say, hey, would you be willing to do a presentation online, in person, whatever? And most of us will do it for free. A lot of this is finding those hotspots, right? We all know that everybody has a hotspot. And whether that's if your department is focused on, in Canada, we have a major fentanyl problem. If it's all about fentanyl, then go out, do the research, find the hotspots, show how you can use it to further the fentanyl investigation. If that means that you're doing research on exploited women and human trafficking as a journalist, that if you want to get the resources, you have to actually demonstrate, here's how I am doing this work and here's some of the gains that we can get from it. But again, a really powerful thing I often find is bringing someone in, telling someone a problem, someone who's really good at open source intelligence, saying, here's what our department or our organization is really concerned about. And someone with no knowledge like me, I'm not a law enforcement member and I never have been. But if I come in and do a presentation for 45 minutes on all the gangs, drugs, and violence that I can find online with zero law enforcement training and no ability to know which gangs are important or not, but I still find all this stuff, then that's telling you that with some really highly trained professionals, you can pull some valuable intelligence out. So it's a context-specific problem, but I always find in every organization there's one or two people who are like the real go-getters when it comes to this stuff, and those people got to take it upon themselves to say, you know what, I'm going to do everything I can to try to teach people this internally, or I'm going to go out and ask for help to help me sell this so that people will believe me. And sometimes selling it doesn't mean money, right? It literally doesn't. It just means getting people to even just believe that this is something useful. One of my favorite things that I hear a lot from people who have been, for example, an investigative journalist or an investigator or law enforcement for a number of years is, you know, F Facebook, right? I don't need Facebook. I've been doing investigations for 20 years. Totally agree, right? Totally agree. However, it's always a nice thing when those people start to see how, even if they do 99.9% of their investigative work traditionally, that they can add that little tiny bit of additional stuff on top, and you just never know when you're going to find that extra breadcrumb that's going to help you. So that's all I can recommend to people who are trying to sell this stuff internally is, if you're passionate about it, let that passion come out. You know what's best for your organization, and don't be afraid to reach out to the community, meaning people like myself or Michael Bazell or others, or look on YouTube, look on in forums or wherever you can to try to get people to really buy into this. It's the only way you're going to get it through.
Two of the projects that you worked on that you wrote about in your website were really interesting. One was you did sort of an examination of indictments of street gang members in Detroit. And then you also looked at the translated papers that were captured from the Osama bin Laden raid. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about those, because they're nice and very different subjects, and talk about sort of the information of value that you pulled from those.
Sure. So for the gangs of Detroit, really, it was a couple of news articles that I'd seen, and mainly what caught my attention was the fact that these gangs had used social media as a way to kind of stake their territory, let people know where they were, let them know who they associated with. But what I found really interesting was being able to, for example, look at those indictment papers and say, what can we learn about this group? And then what can we go out and search? What can we validate? And this is especially useful for journalists or people who are doing maybe a larger scale gang analysis work. The indictment papers and maybe the court paperwork is going to tell you a lot about what's going on at the trial, but what about the stuff that's out there in the open? And of course, now that some of these guys are in jail, who are their supporters? Who are the people who remained out of jail and are still tweeting? Who are posting pictures? So that was one of those things where it was more telling people, like, indictment papers and court cases, a lot of people look at as kind of the end of the intelligence line, because now it's time to actually present evidence. There's obviously a vast difference between evidence and intelligence. And so I was trying to show people that, no, listen, these indictment papers are actually an amazing source of intelligence that you can use to do further research and monitoring and all this other stuff just by, and I believe, used a regular highlighter to just highlight terms. I printed out the indictment papers and just highlighted terms and hashtags and whatever, and then started plugging them into Twitter, and it worked amazingly well. Conversely, that was more of a manual approach, like just kind of printing off paperwork, highlighting stuff and starting to punch it in. The opposite of that was the analysis of the Bin Laden papers, where I believe there's about 100 documents or something put up by the ODNI. And, you know, my whole thing was, I don't really want to have to read through every one of these documents to try to figure out what kind of information is present, right? I was more interested in what was he talking about in these papers, or what was found in these papers as overall topics. What were the most common things that could be found in these papers? And that was just kind of my research question. So what I demonstrated to people was just being able to write some code to pull down all these documents, automatically analyze them, leverage some free tools online to be able to pull back what were the most common things that were talked about, and then see what the results were. And this actually spun off into more than one blog post as people kind of came back. Of course, people who were Bin Laden analysts and who knew a lot about him, of course, came back and kind of had some of this back and forth with me, like, hey, that's not accurate and this is. And of course, this is exactly what you want. You want to continually refine these techniques. But I think the interesting thing was, of course, that these are two different approaches. The Gangs of Detroit and the Bin Laden papers were two different approaches, two different sets of data. But you could have equally applied either one of them in both directions to get some additional intelligence and some learn some things. But this is really the overarching thing, is that if you're a researcher, it's all about asking these questions and then trying to find the answers. And as long as you have that curiosity and that desire to answer the questions, you're always going to be amazed at how you can just pull things out of what appear to be innocuous documents or dry material, how you can pull some really cool stuff out and really even generate additional ideas for further research, which this fits more for people who are doing analyst work type work, not necessarily case-specific investigative work, but doing larger scale analysis.
Yeah, I mean, this is when I was reading those, the one thing that really struck me was, you know, the whole idea of sort of shelf life of value of information, and that information that is maybe 6 months, a year, 2 years, even 5 or more years old still can have really important intelligence value in terms of giving you insight into the environment that you're working in, your opponents, all that sort of thing. So I really liked those, that even though the gang case was great, the case was closed, suspects were put in jail or cases were adjudicated somehow, and yet there's still valuable information in there because, like you said, there's still social networks in existence, and they're probably still using those same terms, operating in those same areas. So, yeah, I really thought that underscored that wonderfully. The other thing, let's flip it around, if we could, and talk a little bit about, we had the attack in Orlando a little while ago. Just today, there was another, doesn't look like it was a terrorist attack, but another sort of scare in Germany in a mall. How about immediate sort of open source intelligence value? As an event is breaking, what sort of possibilities are out there, and what are, you know, what's probably too ambitious to expect?
Well, I think it's always the case that breaking news is usually broken. And, you know, I don't think that changes with social media. I mean, too often we've seen a reactive kind of situations from attacks and stuff that are going on at the time. Now, the interesting thing, of course, to me is being able to monitor this stuff in real time is a capability that really was not available to individuals for a long time. And now we do have the ability to do that. But I think we have to use the exact same caution that we use anywhere else, that live monitoring is great to give you a general idea of overall activity and potentially give you a bit of intelligence. But usually you can't make any sense out of it until long afterwards, when some of the things start coming back that are actually true. I know in the attacks in Canada, when they went down, there was initially 3 shooters, multiple locations. Then there was 2 shooters with 3 locations. Then it turned out to be 1 shooter and 1 casualty. I think that these are exactly something that, as you were watching it from social media, like at some point you started to think, is there like an entire group of people running around downtown Ottawa shooting the place up, or what is going on? And even the news agencies were doing the same. And I think this is where there's a lot of utility in having this information stored. But I think we also have to look at the fact that we still are not to the point that we can truly make sense of what's going on the ground without having someone in the middle on the ground actually reporting back. So I always like to include that, you know, open source intelligence is great, and that's what we're here to talk about. But it is not the silver bullet. It is not designed to replace human intelligence or signals intelligence. It should be used as an overall thing to help augment and to help correlate and corroborate things that you're learning from other sources.
Yeah, I mean, when you mentioned the Ottawa attack, that very same thing. I remember watching the Boston bombings unfold, and there was the bombing, then there was reports of shootings, and there were reports of arsons. And it can be very easy to get sort of sucked into a Twitter feed and just start watching information roll off and start to treat that as vetted information when it's nowhere near there. And yeah, very much the same. We generally feel it's got to be 12 to 24 hours before we can feel like we have a sense of what's going on if we don't have somebody there, you know, on the ground. That's exactly right. There's one other example I wanted to sort of ask you about. I know you've done some work with a site called Bellingcat, and Alyssa has a link for that website there. A couple things. One, I'd like to know if you could sort of talk a little bit about Bellingcat as an enterprise, sort of what it does, why it does it. And then maybe we can talk about one of my favorite open source intelligence pieces of work they've done.
So I'm going to preface this with saying that I by no means represent Bellingcat. I'm going to do my best to give the general overview of what the group is. And really what it is a bunch of researchers and citizen journalists from around the world who contribute solely by using open source intelligence techniques, or at least at a very high percentage of it is completely open source derived. And so Bellingcat, started by Elliot Higgins a few years ago, really is there to demonstrate the power of the individual behind a keyboard. And even though there's a number of us that do collaborate on project within Bellingcat, you know, with one person, a keen eye, and even very basic skills like being able to look at Google Maps, a perfect example of this, although a grim example, was when, unfortunately, James Foley was beheaded. And of course, the whole world was kind of made aware of this event. People at Bellingcat worked to figure out the location of where that beheading took place. And this was done solely through open source means, by looking at the terrain, by making kind of guesses, gut instinct guesses about locations and all this stuff. They were able to geolocate him where this event took place with really a pretty high degree of accuracy. Now, this is not something new. This is of course, something that, for example, child exploitation investigators, they've been doing this for years. I mean, years and years. And some of you might even be in here right now who do this work, and you should be nodding your head right now, like looking at photographs, looking at the patterns on curtains, looking at the shape of streetlights. All of this stuff has been done for a long time. But what Bellingcat has done is really brought it to the public's eye and kind of brought it out from kind of the dark corners of the internet and shown how the average person is actually an amazingly powerful intelligence organization. Just with one person, you can do a lot of amazing things. So this is really what they do. They've also spent a lot of time working on, in particular, the MH17, the airliner that was shot down over the Ukraine, of course, with all of the additional stuff that's come out about that. So there's a lot of work that they've done around that as well. I can't say enough. There's some incredibly intelligent, very amazing researchers that work on this team, and they come from all walks of life, from computer people like myself to people who used to be like financial paper pushers to traditional journalism types. So it's an amazing cross mix of people with a lot of different capabilities.
Even if you don't think you're interested in something like the Malaysian aircraft getting shot down over Ukraine, the amount of work and deductions and just evidence they were able to acquire solely from open source information, it's really staggering. They were able to trace the, if I remember this correct, the actual sort of rocket launching vehicle from its base in Russia, eventually identify sort of the unit it was with, the individual Russian soldiers who were in that unit. I think they came out with a pretty high confidence of being able to identify this specific vehicle and even the specific name of the commander of that vehicle who would have most likely ordered the launch of that missile. And again, all of that from open source intelligence, really incredible. And then a more recent one, I'm not sure if you saw this, Justin, or not. ISIS had released, they were releasing a statement, and for a little while, ISIS fans had gotten a particular hashtag trending. And a few ISIS sympathizers around the world took basically some pictures of maybe a note card with a written statement of support, and then just sort of demonstrated that they were wherever, in a place in Europe, in a place in Canada, I'm kind of making those up, just to sort of to give the idea that they're everywhere. And I think Elliot Higgins, the guy who runs Bellingcat, he posted a couple pictures on Twitter and said, let's try to find out where these were. And there was not much in these photographs. There was a little bit of generic background, street background, and I think they ended up identifying the specific street in four of these cases and then forwarded them along to the authorities. I think in the Netherlands, they had particular insight. And some of that sleuth work was done by somebody identifying sort of advertising on bus stops. And they said, here are all the bus stops in this city that this person identified. These are the only ones that have advertising on them. This is the only one with this piece of advertising. This guy was on this street corner at this time. Absolutely amazing work.
That's right. Yeah, and I think, you know, this is really, I mean, when you boil it down again, this kind of goes back to our previous conversation on barriers to entry. I mean, the beautiful thing and the reason why I like sending people to Bellingcat is because, again, that big mental hurdle is when you hear about the result of the investigation, in your mind, you've set this up to be like this incredibly complicated, you know, multi-tool, 10 years of training kind of thing to pull this off. But when you actually just take, if you read through a couple of those articles, just slowly, very quickly, you realize that, hey, you know what these guys are doing? They're taking one image and really paying attention. That's it, right? It's like, where's Waldo? I mean, you can't find Waldo if you just scan a page and say, okay, I can't find him. You really have to pay attention. You really have to look, take notes. And all of these things, they don't require any technical training. If you can print out one photo and you can operate a pen to paper and take notes, you'd be amazed that if you took note of every single thing that you found in that photograph, that you'd have actually a pretty good profile of where these things are taken. And that's the real brilliance behind these guys at Bellingcat, is that they know this, right? They're just very good at paying attention, very good at looking and fine details. And of course, they've honed this skill so that their time frame, like I've literally seen, I've been on the chat, in the chat room with fellow Bellingcatters, and a photograph has come in, and people are like, okay, let's see who can geolocate this first. And it'll just look like a generic piece of desert. And there's a few folks at Bellingcat that will geolocate that thing in like minutes. And you're like, how? And they're just like, I've just gotten good at it. You know, I've just gotten good at being able to look at these photographs and very quickly start to hone in on particular areas. And I'm terrible at that geolocation stuff, but good at other things. And so this is also the other thing, is that these guys are really approachable as well. If you see somebody who's written an article on Bellingcat and you see their name and you want to ask them a question like, how did you do this? Or what would you suggest? I will guarantee you that they're going to email you back, because the whole purpose is to share information, and they're all very friendly, very approachable people. So go read some of it. And I definitely encourage you to reach out to some of them and engage with them, because you're going to learn a lot.
How do you see intelligence being obtained from mobile platforms like Snapchat or WhatsApp as they integrate more and more encryption in their products?
Well, I think this is where it gets kind of interesting, right? So you're never going to be able to circumvent the encryption, right? I mean, being realistic, in a lot of cases, that's just not going to happen. But the question becomes is, what is the actual target of your gathering? So if you're trying to, for example, just engage with a target, if you're able to do that, then of course the encryption piece is kind of irrelevant, because you just start messaging with them and gathering intelligence from them. But if, for example, that you're looking to find just information out on them, profile-wise, or whether there's a WhatsApp account connected to a particular account, then, you know, those are just little tricks of the trade. And there's all these other things that follow up with it. Like, a lot of people, for example, might not know that you can actually emulate an Android phone right on your computer. So right on your computer screen, you actually could have a window that looks just like your calculator, for example, a little window that would actually be a fully functioning Android phone that you can begin to interact with apps and targets and begin to do investigative work. So the big problem with encryption, and especially when it comes to traditional kind of intelligence work, is the fact that we can't intercept the messages and get any useful information from them, right? So if, for example, myself and Dean are up to no good and we're using clear text, no encryption messaging, so whether that's through email, because email is a form of clear text, or whether that's a messaging platform and me and him are planning something, then of course you as a law enforcement agency or an intelligence agency have the ability to intercept that communication, whether that's at the telecommunications carrier or through satellites or whatever it is. You can intercept it. You can sit in between Dean and I, and you can read all the messages going back and forth, and that's fantastic. The problem with encryption is, of course, is that it kills that ability off. So you can't sit in between us. But that doesn't mean that you can't sit on our phone, so that's a totally different discussion. And that also doesn't mean that you can't pretend to be Dean so that I think about I'm talking to Dean, when in reality I'm talking to an undercover officer, right? And so this is also where I think that people also need to think about the fact that more and more, I think that, and this is again just my opinion, but more and more the way I look at it is the more that encryption usage continues to be adopted, the better we have to be at undercover operations, the better we have to be at open source intelligence. And we have to remember not to forget that I think a lot of signals intelligence work great for a lot of things. And the more and more encryption that's going to be used, the tougher that some of those communications are going to be. And so we have to lean on our other intelligence techniques like human intelligence and open source intelligence to get the results we're after. Again, this is all coming from someone who has no background in law enforcement or intelligence work. That's just my personal opinion.
Justin, you're working open source. So basically the information that you're accessing, if I understand correctly, is accessible by anybody. It requires, and you're not trying to be covert, you're not pretending to be somebody else. This is, it's just a matter of sort of formatting the tools correctly and asking the right questions and getting that information out. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So for privacy issues, I think it's going to depend on sort of who you're asking. So if you're asking government agencies, they will have their own regulations. So there's in the United States, we have the U.S. Constitution, and then different entities and different jurisdictions will have their own laws, regulations, standard operating procedures that will address those.
Well, I think again, too, I mean, you know, and this, you know, becomes more of a philosophical conversation than anything, but it is of my opinion that if you're posting things online, if you're voluntarily engaging in communications online that are available to the general public, that you alone are responsible for those communications, meaning that if I come along and scoop those things up online, the notion of privacy has kind of been thrown out the window, right? Now, I know this is a hot topic with a lot of people, and it's more of a political thing than anything, and we could go on for hours about this. But I often pose to people, especially those who really take a hard line against maybe law enforcement or intelligence agencies, especially in this kind of post-Edward Snowden era, and there's the argument on one side is I have nothing to hide, and then there's the argument on the other side that we should really be wary of these things. But I think what we all need to think about is, from the privacy perspective, the fact of the matter is that you've sold your privacy long before you even got on a social media platform, right? The minute that you've logged into Amazon and ordered a book, you are now a data point across multiple providers, across multiple sites, and they are correlating things about what your sexual preferences are all the way down to what sports you like to play. So you have to think about the fact that if you are going to engage in any of this stuff online, that you alone are responsible for your privacy. And I think, again, in my perspective, and this is only mine, that the minute that people post this stuff online, they no longer have the protections that private communications have. However, what we see is that the laws are now starting to shift, especially when it comes to law enforcement. And we've seen this in Europe, that they can't just go out and collect intelligence on a criminal just because. They actually have to get, much like a warrant in North America, they have to actually get authorization to even go look at somebody's stuff and begin to collect it as evidence. And there's a time window that they're allowed to do that. When that time window has elapsed, they're no longer allowed to. There's a lot of other jurisdictions that it's free reign. You can go out and hunt this stuff online as much as you like. So I think the privacy issues really boil down to, if you're in law enforcement, of course, it's going to be important that you understand the policies and the rules. I think we see things like journalists that operate under a different set of rules and a different set of policies than law enforcement. But I think it's an extremely thorny and complicated issue. But hopefully I've at least helped to give some context, at least where I stand on it and maybe where the general kind of the public stand on a lot of it.
That's great. We also got a question about, do we support using encryption for security? Justin, you're not part of a law enforcement agency. I'm certainly not going to speak on behalf of the agency here, but I'll let you answer that question first. How about that?
Sure. So, you know, I think that encryption is something that's completely your right to use, right? So for the public, I mean, I have customers and clients that I exclusively communicate with using GPG. We are both people who are patriotic people. We love our country. We're not worried about our country intercepting our communications, which is what a lot of people are concerned about. I know my country has better things to do, but I think that it's your right. It's your right to choose the technologies that you wish to communicate with others over, right? And I don't think that us taking a hard line on encryption is really going to get us anywhere. I think what we need to be able to do is stop talking about the problem of encryption and start thinking about the solutions, when it comes to when terrorists use encryption, when organized crime. I mean, when we think about really, this is, and there's a pretty popular case up here in Canada, organized criminals have adopted encryption, have adopted some pretty sophisticated infrastructure for communication. We need to stop thinking about the problem, and really we need to start thinking about, okay, how do we work around these things? When cell phones first came out, they were a problem. When email accounts started being used, they were a problem. There's all these things that we've had to continually adapt to over time. And I think that everybody has a right to communicate in the way that they should be allowed to communicate. And I think that the bad guys are always going to figure out better and better ways to try to hide themselves. And we are always going to have to go through that arms race to continually try to get one step ahead of them, or at least catch them on the step that they're at. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, I think, right, and encryption is sort of only one sort of aspect in which you can secure your data. So data security, you know, when I saw that question, the first thing I began thinking of was data encryption for e-commerce, for example. So you want to know where your personal information, your financial information, how is that being transmitted to your vendor? Where is it being stored? How is it getting sort of translated back to you?
Most recently with the Apple iPhone stuff and all the drama that went on with it. I mean, really, we use encryption every day. We're using it right now in our web browsers. We use it every time we log into our bank accounts. We're using encryption every time we actually swipe our credit cards and other things where the banking systems are using encryption. So we really just need to reframe a lot of this, educate people that there's a lot of ways that this stuff is used for good, right? And that we shouldn't just think that, oh, encryption is just something that ISIS uses to send messages around. What we need to do is really reframe a lot of this. And I think part of that's just education.
Where would you draw the line between intelligence gathering or criminal investigations? Are they mutually exclusive? I don't see them as mutually exclusive, but they're not interchangeable, right? So I don't know if you have any different thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hard for me because I just don't have the background in criminal investigations. I mean, what I do know is that the benchmark for evidence is obviously significantly higher than intelligence. Intelligence is just really set out to answer a question. Evidence is used to actually try to convict somebody. Now, of course, you can use intelligence. Now, this is a perfect example of this is, let's say we're interested in looking at street gangs in Saskatchewan again, and we have the ability to just go out into Facebook and begin to kind of comb around looking for interesting or suspicious things. So that'd be the intelligence gathering part. Now, the trick is, from what I hear, of course, is that once that transitions from intelligence into now we're going to open an investigation, you have to be able to explain how you got there, right? So how did you actually get to the point that we're now going to open an investigation? Now, the other cool thing is that intelligence in the context of a criminal investigation, when it comes to a law enforcement agency, intelligence is also, especially open source intelligence, you have the ability to marry that to closed source information. So you might have information in a database inside your organization that tells you that, hey, this person has got 17 weapons charges against them. And then you see a picture of them holding a sidearm on Facebook. Well, then, of course, now you have the ability where that line is grayed, where this person definitely should not be holding weapons. You've collected this information online. It's now going to probably be used as evidence in a criminal investigation, but you actually haven't proved that that isn't a paintball gun, that image isn't 10 years old, that, you know, there's a number of other things that need to be kind of put together. But again, even when you think about how intelligence agencies work versus law enforcement in Canada, our domestic intelligence agency doesn't do criminal investigations, quite obviously, and they can't even, I mean, they don't have the abilities or anything else. They're not collecting evidence, whereas our federal police force has to actually take some of those initiated investigations and turn them into criminal investigations by starting at ground zero. So I think this is one of those interesting things that there's some blurring of the lines. But I do see them as different activities, even though a lot of what you know, a lot of the steps you're taking might be similar. So the next question was, you touched on this a bit, but what does OSINT look like in the next 10 years? What would be the challenges? What am I excited about? Well, I'm always excited to talk about OSINT, as you can tell. In the next 10 years, I mean, this is always a tough one because 10 years ago, I would have never predicted that there was going to be this massive uptick on a platform that only lets you type 140 characters. I thought that was silly. Look where we are at now today. I mean, I think we're going to continue to see more and more and more of this stuff become mobile. this is not a big revelation to you. I mean, I'm not telling you something you don't already know. I think the only thing that I can say definitively for the next 10 years is that we are going to be surprised where we're gathering intelligence from in the next 10 years. That's the only thing I can really guarantee. What I'm really excited about, I think what I'm excited about is the fact that the playing field continues to be more and more leveled for independent researchers, data journalists, private investigators, all kinds of people that don't have the same financial or human resources that large organizations do, that the playing field slowly starting getting leveled out, and that we're all able to actually perform a lot of really cool stuff that previously either required a computer science degree or required $1 million, that now this is kind of something that we can all do and all contribute to. And that's really the exciting thing for me. I think right now is really this renaissance period for open source intelligence, which to someone who's been doing OSINT for 30 years is laughing at, because they're saying they've been doing this forever. But right now, I think that the public's paying attention. People like Bellingcat are bringing it to the forefront. I think we're really starting to see this renaissance period, and I'm really excited about that. So the next question was, does the upcoming proliferation of Internet of Things and wearables create more attack vectors for OSINT and or attack? So I think there's two kind of questions there. The first one would really be, is the Internet of Things and wearables, so like watches or Fitbits or what other crazy stuff people are strapping to themselves these days, does that increase your attack surface? And your attack surface, if you've never heard that term before, is basically all the different ways that people can screw you over. Think of it like that way. Any way that an attacker can get at you. And an attacker usually means a hacker, but it can also mean other things. I think that, of course, that with more wearables and Internet of Things, I mean, your thermostat in your house can be hooked up to the Internet. You have washing machines and fridges and everything else that can be hooked up to the Internet. I think that does expose you to more risk. But it's just like anything else. When Microsoft Windows first came out, horribly insecure. 10 years later, still pretty insecure. 20 years later, not very good. But now it's to the point that it's so ubiquitous that, and security is such a huge requirement, that I think that Microsoft took it seriously and has now built a pretty secure platform. We're going to see the same thing. We're going to go through a pain period with IoT and a pain period for wearables, where all you're going to see is bad news about them and failures and all this stuff. Same with critical infrastructure, which is another term for things like SCADA, which is like the stuff that runs nuclear power plants and opens and closes water valves and that type of thing. Everybody's really worried about that. You know, I think it's like anything that we're going to go through a pain period, and eventually we're going to start to see that as these companies mature and the products get further and further along, we're going to see a tightening of security, which is really important for the consumer and for people who aren't very technical to protect themselves. Now, on the open source intelligence side, I think we've already seen a number of examples where people's information for like health tracking apps get leaked, right? So now I can actually see that, hey, look at the route that Dean runs every day. So if I plan on like running him over with a car, I know exactly what intersection and what time I should be there. So I think we've seen that these things, even though they're strapped to you and even though they're a little piece of electronics, they actually give a wealth of information up potentially about who you are, your habits, and other things, which has all kinds of different implications. But this has been something, for example, that has been present for a long time, especially even if you have something like Wi-Fi at your house. So if you have a Wi-Fi router at your house, and if you can go into your Google Earth or Google Maps, and if you can see your house from the street view, right, because the Google car has driven around your block, then what you probably might not have known is that Google has actually scanned your Wi-Fi at the same time, and they can see that your access point was geographically located at that exact spot. Now, me, as a bad guy, what I can do is I can actually sit in an airport in your home city, and if you ever have your phone connected to your Wi-Fi, for example, at home, which a lot of people do, then I can actually sit there and see that your phone is beaconing for that particular access point. So maybe you call it Dean Barata's house, right? And I can see this phone beaconing for Dean Barata's house. What I can do is actually go online and look that Wi-Fi access point name up online, and I might just get a little dot directly over top of your house. So you can see that open source intelligence is not just like social media platforms, that we can actually use physical radio waves and other things to collect intelligence and then augment it with stuff online. And again, so you see how the physical world and the online world are really starting to blend together. And it's not just about Facebook, right? There's all kinds of other places that you can gain intelligence from.
Excellent. Great. Well, Justin, I want to thank you very much for coming here. And this was awesome. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in.
Thanks a lot, you guys, for your time. Thank you, Dean, for having me. This has been fantastic. Please, if you guys have any questions, feel free to shoot me an email. I'm always happy to help. And I want everybody to have a great remainder of their week.
Great. Have a great day, guys.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.